The following is a paid commercial program from the Ulster County Department of Health. This is the Healthy Ulster Radio Show, a weekly talk show exploring community health and sustainability with guests representing a broad spectrum of community partners working to make Ulster County the healthiest in New York State. This program is a community affairs presentation of the Emergency Department at Health Alliance Hospital in Kingston, a member of WMC Health.
Welcome to Healthy Ulster Radio. I am your host, Dr. Carol Smith, Commissioner of Health for Ulster County. With me today is my co-host, Vin Martello, our Director of Community Health Relations. Good morning, Vin.
Good morning, Dr. Smith. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Dr. Smith, today we have a very special edition of Healthy Ulster Radio, and we're going to be talking about gun violence, its impact on our community and our nation, and a recent survey conducted by the world-renowned Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. But before I introduce our guest, you know, I'd like to give our listeners, as we always do, just some statistics to provide a little context around the issue that we're talking about. So according to the CDC, in 2023, the number of firearm deaths, excluding suicides, was 18,874. The number of firearms injuries in 2023, over 36,000. The number of children and teenagers shot in 2023, 6,192, and it's now the leading cause of death among children. And the number of mass shootings in 2023 alone, 656. And we're very fortunate to have with us a very special guest. She is Lisa Geller. She's Senior Advisor for Implementation at the world-renowned Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. So Lisa, welcome to Healthy Ulster Radio.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. We're really grateful. So Lisa, we're delighted that you joined us, but can you begin our discussion with just a very brief history of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions, when, how, and why it got started, and what its mission is?
Absolutely. So our center is housed within the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And we are a center of advocates and researchers whose mission is to reduce all forms of gun violence. And you mentioned at the outset some statistics about gun homicides, gun suicides, and gun injuries, including mass shootings. Our mission is to study the efficacy of policies that reduce gun violence, and then to advocate for those policies at both the state and federal level. Now, our center was formed many, many years ago, but most recently, the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence, where I had worked since 2015, merged with the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Prevention and Policy in April 2022, so almost 2 years ago, to form the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions.
Wonderful, wonderful. So in 2023, Lisa, your center conducted a nationwide survey on American beliefs around gun safety and gun violence prevention. How was that survey conducted, and how many people participated?
Our center has conducted these surveys every 2 years since 2013, so right after the Sandy Hook shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. So we've been doing this for over a decade now. Our most recent survey included over 3,000 respondents, and that included a little over 1,000 gun owners and a little over 2,000 non-gun owners. We made sure to include a breakdown by party affiliation as well. And so we had a sample of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. And we think this is important because, of course, we want to get a picture of what the U.S. is. And by just surveying gun owners or just surveying non-gun owners, we're not really able to understand the attitudes and beliefs around gun safety and gun violence prevention policies. So our most recent survey, which, as you noted, was in 2023, included this representative sample around the country.
And Lisa, from my readings, and I'm certainly not an expert on the subject, there appears to be a pretty widespread popular belief that most Americans don't support gun safety requirements at all with respect to their Second Amendment rights. However, the data seemed to reveal something different. Can you talk about that a little?
That's correct. And that's one of the myths I hope to dispel on your show, because in fact, this survey and surveys that we've conducted in past years found really broad agreement among Americans, including gun owners, non-gun owners, and regardless of folks' political affiliation, for a whole host of gun violence prevention policies. And I'll get into some of the specifics later on in the show. But we looked at attitudes and beliefs and general support for prohibiting domestic abusers from having firearms, or allowing for extremist protection orders or red flag laws, and firearm purchaser licensing, along with a whole host of other policies. And really the main takeaway that I want you all to get from this survey is that there was widespread support for every single one of these policies.
Amazing. And, you know, Lisa, one of the things that always perplexed me is that, you know, when, you know, with all of the gun violence incidents and mass shootings and everything that, you know, gun rights supporters keep on talking about, and politicians about, it's a mental health issue. It's not a gun issue. It's a mental health issue, not a gun issue. But if you you look at the violent homicides and certainly the mass shootings, obviously, if someone's going to go out and do a mass shooting, they have very serious behavioral mental health issues. But is the problem really, I mean, couldn't both things be true, that it is a mental health issue married to easy access to guns, and that's really the problem?
So we live in a country with more guns than people. And in many, many states, it's easier to get a gun than to, say, get Benadryl at the pharmacy. So to say our gun violence crisis is not a gun problem is incorrect. However, that said, there are, of course, other factors that contribute to gun violence. There are factors that contribute to gun suicides and homicides, including mass shootings and domestic violence homicides. And in some cases, serious mental illness may play a role. I also don't want to conflate mental illness and mental health, because there might be an individual with a mental health crisis, but when we look at the specific case, we might not discover that that individual actually had a diagnosable mental illness. In some cases, again, serious mental illness may play a role. There might be more of association between committing a mass shooting and having a diagnosable mental illness. There might also be more of an association between an individual who dies by suicide or attempts suicide and having a mental health illness. But when we look at the data, we see that individuals living with mental illness, again, individuals that have a diagnosable mental illness, are more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. And I'm particularly talking about interpersonal violence. So to be clear, I of course support more mental health resources and funding. But if we aim to address gun violence, gun injuries, gun deaths, by only addressing mental health, we really won't see meaningful reductions in violence.
Right. I think, you know, the classic example that I go back to goes back to the founding of the center, or the merging of the center, was with Adam Lanza, who was the young man involved in the Sandy Hook shooting. He had, I forget what, attention deficit disorder or something of that nature. He was suspended from school. He went to several counseling sessions, stopped going, dropped off of everyone's radar screen, and now he's in mom's basement with the windows blacked out, playing violent video games all day with a unlocked cabinet full of guns upstairs. And his mom, unfortunately, was the first victim of his shooting. So, you know, there was just that, you know, he dropped out of the system, dropped out of the care system of care, and then had access to guns. It just seems like, you know, and I had a young daughter in fourth grade at the time, so it was really personal for me as well.
Exactly what you say. There are many ways in which people get detached from the system, for lack of a better term. And that means that there's a lot of opportunities for intervention. We, of course, wouldn't say that violent video games contributed to the right. mass shooting that he perpetrated, but there are so many areas for intervention, particularly for mass shooters who often display those warning signs and actually leakage before committing an act, and therefore a lot of areas for us to intervene, either through policy or social services. I also want to say, back to the point about mental illness, is that many Americans do live with mental illness, and most Americans don't commit gun violence or the most severe forms of gun violence, gun homicides and mass shootings. In fact, about 1 in 5 Americans have a diagnosable mental illness, and that could be, like you said, anxiety, depression, ADHD, and about 1 in 25 Americans have a serious mental illness that could be schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. And so when we break down those numbers and look at the population of the US, that's tens of millions of people. And when we look at the gun violence statistics, as you brought up in the beginning, we see that there are about nearly 50,000 gun deaths in 2022. But of course, that's not millions of gun deaths.
This is really a fascinating topic. I mean, I've been thinking about it for years, ever since Sandy Hook, in fact, and, you know, being a public health professional, you know, studying it myself on a regular basis. But Lisa, we want to know a lot more about this, but first we're going to take a very short break. You're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. We're discussing gun violence and its impact on our community and nation with Lisa Geller from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. We'll be back after these words.
Westchester Medical Center Health Network's new Health Alliance Hospital is open in Kingston at 105 Mary's Avenue. The new hospital delivers on WMC Health's commitment to provide access to advanced healthcare right here in this community. Our comfortable and welcoming new Health Alliance Hospital has highly skilled doctors, nurses, and staff. We are ready to make your healthcare experience the best it can be. Here are just a few of the services ready to take care of you and your loved ones when you need us. A new emergency department with 24/7 triage for behavioral health needs, life-saving advanced cardiology programs, family birth center, private rooms, precise imaging technology, critical care support. And later this year, our inpatient psychiatry program will be reestablished to complement existing emergency and outpatient programs. Go to hahv.org for information. That's hahv.org.
And now, Healthy Ulster continues. This is a weekly presentation of the Ulster County Department of Health on 92.9 and 96.5 WBPM.
Welcome back. You are listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. Our special guest today is Lisa Geller from the Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health, a Center for Gun Violence
Solutions.
Before the break, you know, we were talking about mental health issues, and true, you know, our society in this country does have more than its share of folks with mental health issues of varying degrees of severity. That's a given. However, when you deal with a public health threat, public health emergency, which is what we're dealing with, it really demands that we apply a multi-pronged approach where we look at the mental health issues. We try to do something in order to support people suffering from mental health issues, but we also limit access to lethal means that make it so easy, so to speak, for people to either use guns to commit suicide, to commit homicide, to commit mass murders. And it's this kind of huge issue really requires a multi-pronged attack and approach in order to change the course of this epidemic. Lisa, would you like to talk a little bit more about some of the advocacy that we may have out there to limit access to lethal means, i.e. guns?
You're spot on. We always talk about gun violence as a public health emergency, a public health crisis, and therefore we utilize a public health approach. And what that means, what we think that means, is we broadly follow a four-step approach, which starts with defining and monitoring the problem. Gun violence is so complex that you can't take one solution or one policy intervention and expect it to address firearm suicides and firearm homicides, and more specifically within that, domestic violence homicides. So we really need to narrow our focus when we're beginning this approach and define that problem, monitor it. The next thing we want to do is identify those risk factors and protective factors. So when we're talking about someone who's likely to commit violence, one of the risk factors would be a history of violence. And we know that. We know that someone who has committed violence in the past is more likely to commit it in the future. And at the same time, there are protective factors. Strong social connection, social supports can be associated with reductions in violence and decrease the likelihood. And then we get to the policy part, which is developing and testing strategies. There are a whole host of strategies and interventions that we work on at the Center for Gun Violence Solutions, including prohibiting individuals with domestic violence histories from having firearms, including red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders, which you have in New York, as do 20 other states in the District of Columbia. And then what we want to do is ensure that states and localities and ideally the federal government adopts these strategies and implements them effectively, because we know that just because a state has a policy or has an intervention or has some social services or supports, if people don't know about it and if it's not being implemented, it doesn't really do any good. And so we like to use that approach. And we also like to frame this as something that's preventable. The whole point of public health is that we can intervene and prevent something from happening instead of responding to it.
Lisa, apropos of what you said, here in Ulster County, I sit on our Suicide Prevention Coalition, have for many years. We have a very high rate of suicide. And if you look at the statistics, they're primarily the biggest group is older men. And the predominant means is through guns, which is the most lethal force. Because in suicide prevention, you know, if you can put a stopgap, if you can buy some time for the individual to reconsider their decision to commit suicide, if they haven't used the lethal means and haven't been successful, there's a lot of opportunity to help that person with care and counseling and whatever needs to be done to help them move through this. But when a gun is involved, it's a done deal. You know, we've been very successful at working with our gun community through our sportsmen's clubs and our gun shop owners to get information out, to help people understand that if they have a friend or a loved one, even that's going through, you know, some serious challenges in their life, whatever that may be, and that they're really stressed, they have guns, that, you know, that those guns can temporarily be removed and, you know, they're still owned by the individual, but temporarily removed until that person can work through whatever it is. And that's really what the idea behind red flag laws are. Can you talk about that in your research a little bit?
That's correct. So as you noted, suicides make up the majority of gun deaths in this country, and most suicides are by firearm. And that's because, just as you noted, when someone attempts suicide with a firearm, they rarely survive. They don't get that second chance. So putting time and space between someone and their firearm can often be the difference between life and death. And that's what red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders aim to do. As I mentioned earlier, New York is one of the 21 states and DC with a red flag law. These are civil protection orders that temporarily remove firearms from someone at risk of suicide and or interpersonal violence. And we actually have data showing that this is an effective suicide prevention tool. A study of Connecticut's red flag style law estimated that for every 10 to 20 firearm removals issued, one death by suicide was prevented. And in my work, I do a lot of work on red flag laws. We see so many case studies, so many examples from states showing how red flag laws are used as a suicide prevention tool. And we also know that they're popular. Bringing it back to the survey, which I know we mentioned at the outset, our public opinion survey from our center that my colleagues conducted found that over 75% of Americans support this policy.
Is that across the board with all the groups, you know, what it, in different party affiliations and gun owners and non-gun owners alike?
There are variations when you look at the specifics, but overwhelmingly Overwhelmingly, there's widespread support. So our survey found that about 90% of Democrats support extremist protection orders, about 72% of gun owners, and about 76% of Americans overall.
Wow. And that 72%, that rings a bell, because I remember reading somewhere that 72 or thereabouts percent of NRA members support reasonable gun safety measures.
Yes, we see time and time again, these policies have widespread support, as they should, because they're common sense, they save lives, and they don't infringe on an individual's right.
And Lisa, you mentioned the nexus between domestic violence and guns and homicides, you know, with domestic violence. Can you just elaborate on that just a bit?
Thank you for asking that question. My research and passion is really on the intersection between domestic violence and firearms. And what I've seen and what I can tell you is that having a history of domestic violence is a risk factor for so many forms of violence. And the data really is clear that having access to a firearm in a domestic violence situation increases the risk of serious harm, including homicide, including mass shootings. Now, I wrote a paper a couple of years ago that looked at mass shootings from 2014 to 2019. I reviewed every single mass shooting in which there were four or more people shot and killed, excluding the perpetrator. And I looked at individuals' histories of violence and looked at the individuals that they shot and killed during the mass shooting. And what I found, what we found, my colleagues and I, was that almost 70% of mass shootings have a domestic violence connection, meaning that the perpetrator killed at least one partner or family member, or they had a history of domestic violence. So when we're talking about ways to prevent mass shootings as well, we need to look at what leads to the mass shootings, or what the individual, the perpetrator's risk factors and histories are. And time again, we see domestic violence being a big contributor.
So Lisa, in 2 minutes that we have left, and I want to make sure that we get your contact information as well, but where do you see the epidemic of gun violence headed from your perspective? You have a pretty big, you know, vantage point to see what's going on around the country. Where do you think it's going?
I'll start with the negatives and then, of course, end with the positives. Unfortunately, if states continue to roll back their gun violence prevention policies and make it easier to get firearms and more guns flow through our communities, we will continue to see sky-high rates of gun violence, and those rates will go up. However, our center studies the efficacy of gun policies. And as we talked about today, we poll Americans about how they feel about these policies, and we advocate for those backed by evidence. And we have seen so many states pass gun violence prevention laws that make it harder for people who shouldn't have a gun to get a gun. And we've also seen through this conversation that we have the public on our side, which is, of course, helpful. These policies are backed by evidence. They are popular and relatively easy to implement, depending on the policy we're talking about.
So, Lisa, where do listeners go if they want more information? How do they go to reach the center website and so on?
You can use your preferred search engine. You can use Google to search for the Center for Gun Violence Solutions. We're also on Twitter. I know it's not called that anymore. That's what I still call it. Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're on LinkedIn. We're on Instagram. I am on all of those platforms as well. So please stay in touch with the center, with myself, and reach out if we can talk more about this in the future.
And that's the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. So Lisa, thank you so much for being here. We can't tell you how grateful we are for being here and for all of the work that you and your colleagues do on behalf of all of us to help keep us safe.
Thank you, Lisa. We appreciate everything you've done.
You're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. Tune in next week for more great information that you can use to keep yourself, your family, and our community healthy and strong. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Healthy Ulster Radio Show from the Ulster County Department of Health. This program is a weekly community affairs presentation sponsored by the Emergency Department at Health Alliance Hospital in Kingston, a member of WMC Health. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us for another edition of the Healthy Ulster Radio Show next weekend.